I'm Julian Franklin, and this is the sixth in a series of discussions with C. Northcote Parkinson, the British political scientist and historian, on the evolution of political forms. Up to this point, Professor Parkinson, we've been considering not only your theory of political cycles in general, but the special cases of monarchy and oligarchy. Now we come to democracy. Could you tell us how this next step in the cycle comes about?
The actual origin of democracy, I've tried to show, is biological. You have something in the form of an aristocracy, a rule by a few. And as time goes on, that few becomes more numerous. It becomes more numerous in the first place by a process of breeding. An aristocracy becomes a more numerous aristocracy. And this is a matter of common observation, that unless you have a very strict rule confining aristocratic privilege to eldest sons, it's bound to spread, and more people are claiming aristocratic privilege, whatever it is. And then it spreads to some extent in war, because your leaders in war sometimes turn out not to be aristocratic by birth, and you have to pretend they are, and so they get ennobled, they become incorporated in some way in the exclusive society. And so one way and another, partly by war, partly by administration, partly by wealth, partly by professional skill, more and more people claim the status of aristocrat, gentleman, whatever it is, and with it the political powers. And so bit by bit, the number having this sort of status grows, and possibly in the last stages the thing then gets hastened by something in the nature of a revolution. But the process is almost inevitable.
An aristocracy, after all, does make some attempt to maintain its own cohesion. Wouldn't then there be non-biological factors governing its failures or successes in this attempt? Such as, for example, the growth of trade and industry, which might create a middle class, making it much more difficult for the aristocracy to maintain power now that a competing social class is becoming more important.
The growth of trade and industry certainly tends to water down an aristocracy by introducing new elements whose claim to importance is on economic rather than on other, say, grounds of birth. But one way and another, the history of aristocracies is one of the extension of privileges to a wider and wider circle. That's the case very much in England, where the middle class has all assumed the status of gentlemen, which was previously that of a few. And the comparison that occurred that seems to me particularly striking in this is that whereas in England the hated official known as the Collector of Inland Revenue addresses the envelope demanding large sums, as I think very unjustly. When he does that, he addresses the envelope esquire now to everybody who pays taxes. And in the same way you find, going back to ancient India, the saying there that in some of these republics everyone thought himself the Raja. It's rather the same thing, this sort of status of Raja, or the status in England of esquire, which used to be quite limited to landowners of a certain degree of wealth, is gradually comes to be claimed by everybody.
Well, we had our own version of that here in the 30s, you know. Huey Long's slogan was every man a king. I doubt if that meant they were all descended from royalty.
I expect they all had to pay taxes there.
But in your discussion of Greek democracy, you called it as real a democracy as has ever perhaps existed. Do you think that Greek democracy is more democratic than contemporary democracy, or is even comparable to it?
Well, it differed in this way. First of all, it was limited in certain definite respects. Women, for example, were ruled out. The very young were ruled out. Well, they still are under most voting systems. But in addition, they ruled out the entire working class, which in the Greek city consisted of slaves, and the slaves naturally had no vote. They also ruled out all people they regarded as aliens. The new citizens of a modern democracy had no vote in Athens. They were still foreigners. and they had all the privileges of paying taxes, but none of the privileges of directly voting. And to that extent, the Athenian democracy was limited. It was the rule of a good few people, but certainly not of a majority. Perhaps a sixth of the actual population might be in a position to exercise political privileges. But as against that, and this is where the Greeks are so much more democratic than we could claim to be in any country today, that their democracy was direct. Instead of electing representatives who would do things, they themselves were entitled to meet en masse in the marketplace so that all the voters could come together and make their will directly known on a particular issue. Well, you see, in one sense, perhaps they were less democratic. In another sense, they were at least more directly democratic than the modern democracies, as we call them, could claim to be.
How about guarantees of individual freedom in Greece? I mean, constitutional guarantees.
I don't know that their constitutional guarantees were particularly effective. We all know that Socrates ran into heap big trouble, as they say, when he failed to toe the party line in matters particularly of religion. He was not the only person to run into that sort of trouble. I think they were intolerant upon a fair number of matters of that kind. They were also very much inclined to tax their wealthier citizens out of existence, or at any rate out of the ranks of the wealthy, by rather penal exactions, and of course they had no constitutional guarantees against that. In fact, the jury system of Greece, or of Athens at any rate, which provided for enormous numbers of jurymen in a court, 5,000 technically at some occasions, are anything but a guarantee of justice. It is merely making a democratic vote of a matter which should be a judicial decision.
In other words, you say that there's a much greater emphasis upon the autonomy of the individual in modern democracy, although you may not always feel that that's the most democratic element in the Constitution.
Well, in some ways there is, but you have to remember that in the modern civilization, the privileges of the individual have been reduced in a whole lot of other ways. For example, in the education of children in many countries, the individual has very little liberty to choose between one school and another. He certainly can't choose in most countries as to whether to educate his children or not. Perhaps I wouldn't call it an infringement of the liberty of the subject that when he sees a red light in the street, he stops his car, or when he sees a red sign saying don't walk, he stays on the curb. These are all limitations on freedom which are in the nature of modern civilization, but they certainly represent a whole string of limitations on freedom which Athenian of ancient times never knew.
Well, according to your view of cycles, every regime has certain characteristic defects. What were some of the defects of Athenian democracy as you saw them?
Well, the first one, to my mind, is this question of taxation and finance. If you give a large number of poor people the vote, they vote to take the money from the wealthy. That's what Gandhi observed, and which he thought was the weakness of Western democracy in our time. Well, it was certainly equally true of ancient Greece, that the poor, or relatively poor, who went the lowest classes, we know, but still there were quite enough voters in Athens who could look with envy on the wealthier citizens and think that it would be better if their property was redistributed among themselves. And that's in fact what they did. Now, this created in Athens exactly the internal strains and hostilities which Gandhi observed in modern democracy. And the effect is to create resentments among people who have been deprived of their property under one excuse or another, and who therefore, in some measure, turn traitor to the state as such. They're aggrieved, they feel they've been unjustly treated, and in the case of Athens, a number of them, in fact, went over to the other side in various wars that took place, and proved, in fact, extremely dangerous to Athens, because some of them were extremely able men.
Do you regard this tendency of the poor in ancient democracies to take sanctions against the rich as being fundamentally the same thing as contemporary socialisms?
Yes, I think the motive is exactly the same. Some of the details are different, the methods are rather different, but the basic thing is exactly the same. It hasn't with us as yet, I'm referring now to England or the United States, it hasn't produced that extreme resentment which turns itself into actual betrayal of the country concerned. On the other hand, you can certainly find it in Germany, or perhaps Italy, of the 20th century, very much that motive at work, and with quite considerable results.
Well, do you think that a democracy can function successfully without a great degree of economic equality?
No, I don't think it can. I think that it can function perhaps for a time, but in the long run, to talk about people being politically equal and stressing their political equality is bound to create a contrast in the minds of those who see that their political equality is unmatched by any economic equality. The poor man can be told, you are the equal of the millionaire, you have a vote, he has a vote, you have to obey the laws, he has to obey the laws, you are equal citizens before the law, you are equally bound in loyalty to the Constitution of the United States. There are all sorts of points of equality of a political and legal kind which you can emphasize if you want. But to the poor man, he still says, but he's a millionaire and I'm a poor man. He shoots past in his expensive car and I have to take a bus. And that economic equality seems to the poor man far more important than any of the political equalities which you've told him about at his school.
It's your opinion, then, that socialism in contemporary Europe is more the outcome of the projection of political equality into the economic sphere than the consequence of social changes and discontents projected into the political sphere?
To my mind, it's the inevitable logical sequel to political equality. Once you've put yourself in the liberal point of view, you've accepted the liberal slogan that all men are equal, that all have the same rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The next logical step from that is socialism. I see no way out of it.
You've been saying that to achieve social equality, a major political transformation seems to be required. But perhaps we Americans have come up with a quiet formula all our own. It seems, after all, that almost any farmer can drive a Cadillac. Of course, he's got to be able to meet his credit payments.
There's something in that, but what the rich man may have that the rather less rich man, though I'm not certain that your farmers can really be counted as among the poverty-stricken, so far as I understand the problem, but where the rich man may possibly create envy is when he controls two newspapers and a television circuit and can influence opinion on a very large scale. And if you have political power held by individuals on that scale, and I think you'd agree that in the United States that's not unknown, you will then get a demand again for equality to the point of expropriating the rich man from his control of means of communication.
Well, that may come about someday, but at the moment, the American philosophy seems to be that if you can give people enough to consume, they don't care about who controls the economy.
Of course, there is such a thing as a depression or recession when possibly views might change on that, or even over questions of foreign policy.
Have you noticed a tendency for this concept of high consumptive level capitalism to spread to Europe? Some people call it people's capitalism, and others, when they talk about it, think of it as the Americanization of Europe.
No. I don't think that it spread to very much of Europe in its economic sense, the Americanization of Europe is taking place in some measure through those great organs of culture which are situated in Hollywood. And the American way of life is in fact represented in most European cities by these mammoth buildings with comfortable seating and air conditioning and nice carpets up the stairs and beautiful pictures then shown of bathing beauties and gangsters and cowboys and Tarzan of the Apes. This represents American culture to most of the world and does in fact constitute an Americanization of ideas in many directions. But more people can see a film of the American way of life than can afford a Cadillac, except perhaps among the oil magnates of the Middle East.
You said that every regime has to have a theory to justify the way it operates. How does this work with democracy?
I think democracy is rooted in religion, or in particular in one religion, and possibly maybe in others. But the Christianity contains within its body of doctrine the concept of the fatherhood of God, the idea that God is the father of all human beings, which makes human beings brothers and sisters. And if they're brothers and sisters, they're therefore, in a measure, equal. And I think tied up with that is if you believe in a personal God of that kind and imagine him looking down upon mankind, the difference between God and all the individuals composing mankind is so vast that the differences between the individuals themselves become insignificant by comparison. Or it could be put in other terms. One could say that the equality of man consists in very basic things. All men are born in the same way as a result of the same biological process. All men, and including women, man embraces woman, as they say, they all grow up in the same way, they make love to each other in the same way, produce children in the same way, they in the same way tend to show an affection for their children and sometimes an irritation with them as well, they grow old in the same way, and all alike will die. All those are points of equality, or points of similarity at least, between one human being and another. And if you regard those as the most important things, you can accept a very large measure of equality as existing between them.
It's rather difficult, though, isn't it, to move from the Christian notion that all souls are destined to be saved or can be saved to the idea that all men ought to vote?
Yes, the jump there is perceptible. It doesn't follow all that automatically. But if you've once accepted the idea of religious equality, you are at least some way towards the idea that their votes, if they do vote, are of equal value.
Except, of course, that a Christian could say that the freedom of man is something spiritual and inward, and that perhaps the more you suffer and the less power you have in your outer life, the more capacity you have for inward perfection.
That's quite right. There are counterbalancing spiritual virtues which may compensate for physical or mental defects and tend towards an approximate equality. Actually, as a matter of historical evolution, monasteries have given a sort of example of equality and of democracy, which has proved of considerable importance in the development of democratic countries, an example of a society in which all are alike economically. To say they're possessing nothing as individuals. They're probably very much alike in education, because in general the monastic life has been reserved for those who are literate at least, and often learned. They can't be unequal in the beauty of their wives or the number of their children, because wives and children have been ruled out. And consequently, they have and quite reasonably, had a very fair measure of equality and of democracy in monastic constitutions, the way monasteries and groups of monasteries have in fact been ruled, not only Christian, incidentally, but Buddhist as well.
We usually think in this country, from our experience with the Declaration of Independence, which is mandatory reading in the schools, that democracy has its roots as much in reason as it has in religion, in the idea that since all men are reasonable, then they all ought to be equal.
Are all men reasonable? This is a new idea to me, and women, we usually agree, are unreasonable. But he has a theoretical capacity for thinking, but not all individuals seem to show it in the same degree, and a fair number don't seem to show it at all.
Do you think that when Jefferson wrote the words that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that he was ignoring the fact and unaware of the fact that not all people have equal degrees of intelligence?
I think he got rather carried away by the exuberance of his enthusiasm on that occasion. It's rather significant that after the excitement had passed of the Declaration of Independence, that expressions of that kind were not included in the actual Constitution of the United States, which is a far more matter-of-fact document than the Declaration, as far as I remember.
Well, perhaps you're accusing Jefferson of intemperance here, but I can hardly think of an Englishman being carried away too readily, and yet Jefferson seems to have borrowed very heavily from Locke.
Oh, indeed he did. But there were other Americans who read the Declaration, at least subsequently to the moment of enthusiasm when it was passed, and started looking again at these words about all men are created equal. And then they possibly remembered that they were slave owners, and that this obviously didn't apply to men who were of the wrong color. And then some of them probably thought, well, it didn't apply to women, and probably some elder brothers didn't think it even applied to younger brothers very much when it came to the law of inheritance. And altogether, I think there must have been a body of people who, when it came to the actual Constitution, said, well, all this stuff of Jefferson's may be very fine in its way, but perhaps we'd better omit it on this occasion.
Well, of course, when Jefferson came to spell out the term equality, what he meant, I suppose, was security of life, liberty, and property from unreasonable interference. That might be easily reconciled with a very rather conservative form of political system.
Yeah, I think the original form of the government in the United States was conservative. It was not a revolutionary document, the Constitution of the United States, in any sense.
And without necessarily contradicting Jefferson in word, perhaps there was some contradiction in spirit.
It didn't contradict Jefferson, but it failed to repeat some of his more idealistic remarks.
In view of the vast numbers of obvious and manifest differences among men, the term equality is rather abstract. Perhaps it has some meaning as a moral premise or as a philosophic objective.
Well, that may be so, but perhaps in that case, although I'm a doctor of philosophy, I'm not sufficiently philosophic. Perhaps my friends would add that I'm not sufficiently moral.